Hey guys, how's things? Oh, that's good. Me too. Pretty good. My coffee's cold, but other than that, I'm all right. John Pfeffer's going to be on the show. I like talking with John Pfeffer. You like listening to me talk with John Pfeffer, I believe. I don't know that many people who are really good on Asia stuff, but he's one of them. And that's what he's going to be on to talk about. The pivot, well, parts of it. The madness of Thad. Yeah, Thad, he's a crazy guy. No, that's the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. Yeah, in other words, your money. In other words, hey, we came up with an excuse to take more money. That's the official name of the thing. Oh, that's the unofficial name. Anyway, so he's going to be on to talk about that. Picking a fight with the Chinese. Hey, why not? It's a seventh of the world's population. They've got enough nukes to matter. And they're our biggest trading partner, I think. Maybe second after Canada. And why in the world would we have any conflict with them? I don't know. I guess maybe they're about to take over the world. Well, we better stop them. Ready for that? Anyway, so John Pfeffer, he's going to give us the lowdown on that. And then I got a couple of more invites out. There's something going on in Macedonia. You know what? Wherever anything's going on in the world, you always got to wonder what's the NED got to do with it. Am I right? Of course I'm right. So I don't know what the NED has to do with it. Maybe nothing. Maybe something. So I've got one invite out along those lines. I'm trying to get a hold of Trevor Tim to talk with us about the Patriot Act and the USA Freedom Act and all of this. Pure comedy out of my left eyeball here. I got Alan Greenspan's wife, Andrea Mitchell, keeping us up to date on what you really need to know. They're saying they've released the list of Bin Laden's books. His, and particularly his English language bookshelf. And, oh, look, Noam Chomsky. And, oh, look, Eustace Mullins, the Nazi paper money crank. That's funny. And then when they say texts on the Illuminati, it made me wonder, was it Robert Anton Wilson? Maybe not. But the one that I'm most interested in, they say, and this came out a while ago. In fact, Bin Laden, back when he was still alive and podcasting, actually recommended to the American people, hey, you want to know what this is about and what I'm about and how to put an end to this thing? Read Michael Scheuer's book. Something along those lines. Well, who's Michael Scheuer? Well, he's the guy who wanted to kill Bin Laden more than anybody, even before 9/11. He was the guy who very happily accused Bill Clinton of blowing 10 different chances to kill Bin Laden before September 11th. And complaining about that was why he was exiled from the Bin Laden unit during the time of the 9/11 attack. And then came back later. And then, when the 9/11 Commission report came out, he resigned from the CIA, basically just so that he could write this book and get on TV and talk to the American people. And he said, and look, the whole time he's had one obsession, this whole time is driving home this one point, this whole time, that our government is not being honest with us about the motivation of our attackers. And you know, he's a pretty opinionated guy, but half the time he'll leave his opinion out and he'll say, you know what, Americans, if you want to support Israel and their permanent occupations and regular wars and all this kind of thing, then he's a believer in the American system enough that he thinks, you know, you ought to be able to have that policy if you want. If the majority rules, then go ahead, really. But on the other hand, your opinion should be informed by the fact that that's why we have a terrorist problem. is because the money taken out of our paychecks passes through Washington, D.C. and then lands in Tel Aviv in the form of F-16s and M-16s and the permanent oppression of the people of Palestine. So, hey, but you ought to be fully informed. That's Scheuer's point of view. His own personal point of view is, screw Israel. Why should we sacrifice American lives to support Israel? Can't think of a reason. But his official kind of professional opinion is, you know what? It's up to you, Americans, but you ought to know the truth. The bases in Saudi Arabia, the permanent war against the people of Iraq from 1990 on. Yeah. And, of course, support for all the sultans and kings and dictators and enemies of jihad in the region. That's what got us into this mess in the first place. And, you know, I disagree with Michael Scheuer on quite a few things, man. I think probably anyone of any set of opinions would disagree with Michael Scheuer about some things, one way or the other. But you gotta admit he's honest. I mean, seriously, does anybody think that Michael Scheuer is a liar? Have you ever seen him yelling at Peter King on the House floor? He's testifying before, not the House floor, but the committee room testimony. Screw Israel! Ah! Wow. He's an angry guy, and he doesn't mind letting you know about it. And again, I don't agree with him on everything, and in fact, I think he's probably guilty of some war crimes. Tell you the truth, I don't know exactly what his role was in the torture regime, but I think more I think about it, the more I think he was in on it. But he's not a liar. And so that was what he was trying to tell the American people. And that was why he left his cushy CIA job back in 2004 and 5, was to publish that book so that the American people would have a choice based on real information. They don't hate us because their religion makes them hate freedom and free people, North Americans, Christians, etc. Nope. If religion has anything to do with it, it mandates defensive war on behalf of other innocent Muslims. But, you know, that's nothing really particular to Islam, is it? What would Americans do? Well, look at what Americans do if somebody attacks them. Go and fight for each other, at least, you know, we think, mostly. So anyway, I think that's what's interesting. And, you know, I think the omission in the major media references are interesting, too. Let's have a real discussion about, hey, how about with Michael Scheuer? Let's bring him back on CNN and say, wow, Mr. Scheuer, looks like Bin Laden likes you. Bin Laden says we should read you, so what do you have to say to that? That sounds like a great question for Andrea Mitchell Greenspan to ask. Don't you think? Bring that Scheuer on and give him a chance to explain. What is it that you think that Bin Laden appreciates about your writing, sir? Appreciated. And, you know, I just think it'd make for some fun TV. That's really the thing. Fun TV. All right. And then, you know what? Why not invite Chomsky on, too? How come Chomsky don't ever get on cable TV? I mean, I know you know the answer and everything. And I disagree with Chomsky on tons of things. At least as many as Scheuer. Although, I don't think Chomsky's for war and torture and murder and killing and crazy things like Scheuer is sometimes. But I disagree with Noam Chomsky on tons of things. You know, I believe in freedom, and he's basically a communist. But anyway, he's great on foreign policy. All of his critiques of the American empire are, you know, I don't know, 100% spot on, but they're damn thorough and intelligent and wide-ranging. And why should it be that he never, ever, ever gets a chance to talk to the American people by way of cable TV news? And why wouldn't this be a great opportunity for them to have him on? Seems like a good one.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, guys. All right. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, so hey man, join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Got some good people in there, just like yourself. Go and join up, it's scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need external application of any kind, just use your browser window, fake name, and a captcha, and you're in there. Ain't that cool? Alright. I can't remember why, maybe there was just no room for it. Really wanted to embed the chat room on the front page of Stress, the blog. Should talk with Dave about that. I can't remember why we didn't do it that way. Because wouldn't that be cool if it was on the Stress blog? I don't know. The Stress blog is basically dead anyway. Poor old thing. All right. Anyway, join up the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. Talk about El Caminos and stuff. All right. You might notice if you go to ScottHorton.org in the right-hand margin there, there's a link to Patreon. Now, Patreon is a thing that I don't know if it really applies to me or not. I guess it's supposedly supposed to be about artists, so that you can support artists. And I'm not really an artist. But then again, they have a podcast category, and it seems like artistic types, even if they're not really into foreign policy, they tend to lean anti-war, right? So, I don't know. Sheldon Richman's got a thing on there. He said it's helping with his gas money bill. Ooh, speaking of which, I gotta pay the gas bill. Let me forget about that today. So anyway, yeah, I set up a thing on there. And so far, I have two patrons. And I think the way it works, the best I can tell, is you basically have to sign up for a certain amount per whatever it is. So I set mine up where you can be a patron at $1 per interview, which actually I figured out, I'm guessing, I really didn't count very carefully, but I think that's about 4 dozen a month or so, so 80-something interviews. But here's the deal, too, is you could sign up for less than that. 10 cents, 25 cents, 50 cents per interview. Or you could say, I'll give you $20 per interview, cap at $20 per month, no more than that. And cap it at whatever you want. So it's just another way to help support the show. If you like supporting shows, maybe if you're already on Patreon for other reasons or whatever, you want to add and say, hey, I kicked in 2 cents per time I get a Coburn on here or whatever. There's still two Coburns left. Anyway, so, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, there you go. It's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, or just look at the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org. And, of course, you can still just do singular or sign up for monthly donations at PayPal. You can donate bitcoins, and it's always a standing deal, you know, from at least until I tell you otherwise, that if you donate more than $100 to the show, then I'll send you a silver 1-ounce commodity disc with a QR code on the back. You scan it with your phone, it tells you how much it's worth right this instant on the market. Is that not the most ingenious thing in the whole world? Who needs a face value when you can scan the QR code on the back and get the market value in dollars or whatever terms right there off the bat? It's perfect. It's the best currency ever. The QR code commodity disc. And you get one if you donate more than $100. That's basically the deal. But anyway, I'm sorry, this ain't NPR, and I try not to talk like this. I'd really rather talk you into advertising on this show. You know what I need? More advertisers. You got a business? Maybe you should advertise on the show. By the way, you like things? Maybe you should patronize the people who advertise on this show. You drink coffee? You drink Darren's coffee. You want to buy some gold? Ask Robertson Roberts to help you out. You want to try to figure out whether you want to buy some gold or not? Maybe you should go look at WallStreetWindow.com and read The War State while you're at it. And maybe you should support the Future Freedom Foundation and the Council for the National Interest and things like that, too. Maybe you should say to your boss, man, you hate the government, right? You should support this guy's radio show. Maybe you should say that to yourself. Okay. That's enough of that. On with the show. Patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. That was the last of it. Too many emails. All right. What do we got here? Hirsch. Got to talk about Hirsch some more. So Gareth was on the show yesterday, and Gareth was sticking up for his previous reporting, and Gareth was saying that, he thinks that Al-Qaeda put bin Laden there, not the Pakistanis. And he thinks that the ISI as an institution, not a walk-in or a courier, tipped off the CIA to his location. And then Giraldi comes on the show and says, nah, I don't think so, man. I think Hirsch is right. And he's got an article here at the American Conservative Magazine. Where the hell did it go? Thought I had it. Here we go. How was bin Laden killed? Seymour Hirsch's sources tell a more believable story than the self-serving official White House narrative. So he explained it on the show yesterday, and he says it here. He's not claiming to have, I don't think he's claiming to have corroboration for any of this from his own sources anywhere in here. Maybe one little thing or something. But I think he's just basically going with Hirsch's track record and what makes sense to him. And I think he does refer to some knowledge of his own in here, one or two places. But mostly he's saying that with Carlotta Gall and the other reporting backing him up on a couple of points, and then just his own experience in dealing with Hirsch, he says, again here, he's known Hirsch for 15 years and has a great deal of respect for him as a journalist. He says, I am aware how carefully he vets his information using multiple sourcing for many of his articles, and I know that he has a network of high-level contacts and key positions scattered throughout the defense, intelligence, and national security communities. For this article, he cites and then Giraldi says, I think I know the identities of at least two of his American sources, both of whom are reliable and have access, while one of his other anonymous sources might well be Jonathan Bank, the former CIA station chief in Islamabad. Bod. If Sy says that someone revealed something to him, either on background or anonymously, I'm sure that he accurately conveys what was said. Although that does not necessarily rule out the possibility that the source might be intentionally misleading him or somehow be mistaken. So, that's an important caveat, I think, to say, too. But anyway. So, I don't know. I guess I could try to get Shawkat Kadir back on the show. Kind of. I don't really care that much. I mean, it's only Obama's mythology that the killing of bin Laden meant all that much by the time that they did it. You know, if Bush had decided to actually hunt the guy down and make sure to get him good and killed by Christmas 2001 and then had called the whole war on terror off, now that would have been something. But then he went and created 10,000 bin Ladens, just like his sock puppet dictator Hosni Mubarak warned him would happen, in Iraq. And so, really, at that point, really didn't matter if bin Laden was podcasting from his attic where he was hiding in Pakistan. He had an entire Islamo-fascist caliphate growing up in the former Iraq and Syria. Just a couple of years after he died, anyway. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, I'm Scott. It's my show. I'm doing a show. Hey, check this out. So there's this great lady who's great at doing transcripts. There are very few people who are actually good at doing transcripts. Do you know that? Lots of people like to believe and claim that they can do transcripts well. But then there are very, very few who actually can. And I've had a few, and they come and they go. Miss you, lady whose name begins with a K out there. So this lady, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say her name or not, but anyway, she's one of these really talented transcriptionists. And she said, hey, how about raising money by selling transcripts? So I says, hey, that's a good idea. So I wrote up a page at scotthorton.org/transcripts, and I still got to figure out how to put a PayPal button on there. But then chat room, guys, this is where it's important that you're listening. Hey, listen up, in case you're watching TV or something. I need your advice here, chat room dudes. You can tweet me, too, if you wanted to tweet me at Scott Horton Show. How much should I charge for them? I'm thinking I should charge low, and then I should flog them all the time and try to go with volume, right? And get people who are regular customers buying the transcripts. But then how low is low? So I don't know. I was thinking $5. And then I was also thinking, well, what if you paid $150 and then that got you a lifetime membership to the Transcript Club? And then from now on, as long as somebody orders it up for $5, you don't get every single one from now on. But as long as somebody orders one, you get it too, kind of thing. What do you think of that, chat room dudes? Great idea. iTunes, low price, high volume. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Oh, see, I could sell them on iTunes, could I? The transcripts, could I attach them to the interview somehow, but make them cost money if you get them that way or some kind of crazy thing? That would be kind of cool. I don't know about all this high tech stuff. I need, like, Tommy, my genius neighbor, to move back in next door or something. I used to have this neighbor named Tommy. Genius. Anyway, so what do you guys think, man, about selling them? Is $5 too much even? You think I should just make them like $2 and then just, but try to flog them all the time? Or what do you think? Don't charge a lot. We'll never sell. Yeah, you're right. Maybe they should just be $1. But then I can just say, they're only $1. Get a transcript of this interview. It's just $1 at scotthorton.org/transcripts and just say that all the time. And then maybe try that. I don't know. $1's not very much, though. I'm a very greedy person. I don't know. But yeah, low price, high volume, that's the ticket. I said, wait a minute. I have a very small audience. Maybe I should go for very few, but they cost $30 each. Because I'm only going to get rid of 2 or 3 anyway. Nah, okay, probably not. No, I don't know. Well, we'll try it. We'll try it. But I've had people, over the years ask me, hey, what about transcripts for these things? And I've had transcripts for, you know, some of them from time to time and that kind of stuff. But as a regular ongoing type thing, I haven't. So anyway. I guess wait around and I'll be hectoring you about buying transcripts here in the very near future. Aren't you excited? Cool. All right. Now, Michael Morell, and look, I'm sorry. I don't mean to tell you anything you don't know. I don't mean to claim to. This is just another footnote for you. That's all. It's just another factoid to keep in your brain where you know stuff. George W. Bush's CIA briefer, Michael Morell, who is a liar and a pro-torturer and all this kind of stuff. And so who knows, really? But when they're confirming your bias, you know it's true. That's how you know it's true. George W. Bush's CIA briefer. Bush and Cheney falsely presented WMD intelligence to the public. So what happened was, yes, this is being recorded, live show, but also being recorded in case you're listening to this in the future. It is, the 19th? No, the 20th of May, 2015, 21-5 here. And Chris Matthews, finally decided to get to the bottom of this on his MSNBC show. And so he says to Michael Morelli, he says, oh, so you were briefing George Bush on the intelligence. You were the CIA briefer. So when Dick Cheney said that Saddam Hussein is hard at work reconstituting deliverable nuclear weapons, was that the intelligence? Is that what you told the president was the case, or isn't it? Oh, gee, I don't know. I just, you know, I tell him what I tell him. I don't watch TV. I don't know what you mean. And Matthew says, come on, they're selling the war. They're using your stuff, saying you made that case when you didn't make that case. So Morrell says, oh, blur, da, dur. I'm just telling you what we said. Then Matthew says, they gave a false presentation of what you said to them, meaning Bush Cheney did, of what the CIA said to them. And Morrell says, on some aspects. Blam! There you go. On some aspects. The president and the vice president lied to the American people about the official assessment of the intelligence agencies of the United States of America about what Saddam was doing. Oh, on some aspects, like whether or not he was making nuclear weapons to kill you with. To kill your family with. Stuff like that. They were lying. And you know what? It's your fault if you bought it. You know why? Because back in the fall of 2011, when the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community's national intelligence estimate came out, they said right then, even in the declassified summary and the news coverage of it, at least if you were reading the news coverage of it, that, okay, we think he must have some mustard gas and some sarin still, but we don't think he would ever use it on America unless we invade. And even then, it was wishy-washy. Were they talking about the invading troops or what? He's going to use his magic to somehow use a balsa wood drone to spray your East Coast town with these poison gases. Like in the nonsense, like in Bush's Cincinnati speech of October 2002. His balsa wood unmanned aerial vehicles of destruction. He's going to spray you with germs, cover your house in duct tape and plastic because there's a drone germ attack coming. Yeah, on some aspects, according to the CIA briefer, throwing George W. Bush under the bus, giving complete and total credence to any prosecutor who would want to try George W. Bush for murder, as Vincent Bugliosi recommended. Bugliosi, the guy that prosecuted Charles Manson, he said, look, the NIE says that Saddam Hussein will not attack America, and certainly not with any weapons of mass destruction, unless we attack him. And so then, there's only two answers. Either Condoleezza Rice read that and then lied to George W. Bush about what it said, or she read that, told him the truth about what it said, and then he lied about what it said. Because he said that Iraq was a threat to the United States of America, and that NIE said that it was not. So, who's lying? Rice or Bush? Those are your only two questions. So Bugliosi said, indict Condoleezza Rice, and then watch her squeal like a pig on George W. Bush. He's guilty of murder. He lied the American people into war. As bad as Douglas Feith did. It's not like he was the victim of these liars. He hired them. He was fixing the facts around his policy, you see. Ask Michael Morell, the CIA morning briefer, of George W. Bush. He'll tell you.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I like being a radio show, man. It's all right. It's pretty good. So listen, man, I guess it's kind of fun, isn't it? Watching everybody squirm over the 2003 Iraq War. It's just not going away. How is it that the media decided that this is something that they want to bring up and keep harping on? I'd love to go back and review all their record on it, too. I see people complaining, well, this is a distraction from what we ought to be doing in Iraq now. Not whether we ought to be doing anything in Iraq now, of course. But, of course, it's not a distraction at all. It goes to the heart of what's happening in Iraq now. And, you know, the media, especially for getting into a new war, they've got a lot of making up to do for just the lack of information that they ever provided. All those embedded reporters never had any idea whose side they were on or what the hell their mission was or what they were even doing over there. They're going, yeah, Johnny's a good shot. Okay, great reporting, dude, but who was he killing and on whose behalf? Do you have any idea? Huh? Oh, is that a thing? Yeah, we're fighting for the Iraqi people against the terrorists, right? Thanks a lot for your great journalism, dude. So they never did explain any of that. Now that it's the Islamic State versus the Iran-backed Shiite militias, it's pretty much impossible to deny what's what. And, you know, for anybody who's even 18 years old now, they know, you know, they remember when they were a kid and Iraq wasn't, it was being strangled to death slowly enough. But it was not being bombed and occupied to smithereens. And then it was, and now it is what it is. And, the cause and effect there is pretty simple, pretty obvious, and correct. And it's undeniable. And now this is why Hillary Clinton lost to Barack Obama in the primaries back in 2008. Now she's saying, look, it was a mistake, it was a mistake. But what was the mistake? The mistake, her mistake, was her political judgment. Because the lesson of the first Gulf War was that she and Bill should have supported it. And he almost didn't get the nomination in 92 because he was, quote, bad on the first Gulf War. He opposed it. John Kerry, the exact same thing. I forget Joe Biden. I think he was probably for the first Gulf War. But John Kerry had opposed it. And he and Bill Clinton, boy, did they learn the lesson. And Hillary and Bill Stead in the Senate in 2003, they learned that political lesson, which is if a Republican President Bush is taking the country to war against Iraq, you better get on the bandwagon because later you're going to look like an idiot. And of course, part of the entire package of lies to get us into the war was we can trust these guys uber competence. There have never been such serious men in charge of the government before. Junior, boy, he might be an idiot, but his father's guys, they're some real brilliant managers. They really know what to do. Their competence, the competence of their intelligence and of their management, it was beyond question that they'll know what to do once they occupy the place. So don't question it, was the entire theme back then. And so Hillary made the political calculation that she better support this war, and so she supported it. And if you watch her speech, it's actually full of a bunch of weasel words. It's exactly why Ron Paul always insists on a real declaration of war. He introduced one in the Foreign Affairs Committee and then voted against it and gave a speech that said, you better all vote against it. But if you're for war, you ought to vote for this and take responsibility. It's your declaration of war, instead of authorizing the president to decide so that he has the permission from the Congress, but you're not taking responsibility. You're putting it all on him. That's what Ron Paul said. And Henry Hyde mocked him and said, that part of the Constitution is an anachronism. We don't go by that anymore. No, really, look it up. Ron Paul, 2002, Declaration of War, Iraq. Henry Hyde, remember him from the Judiciary Committee during the impeachment of Bill Clinton? And there he is. He tells Ron Paul, there are parts of the Constitution that we just don't go by anymore. Yeah, like the Bill of Rights. In Article 1, Section 9. But anyway, so Hillary Clinton gets up there and says, well, you know, I'm not saying I'm for war. I'm just saying I am for giving the president the authorization to go to war so that he can credibly threaten Saddam Hussein with war in order that we can get the inspections done and then hopefully avoid a war, but then only have a war if we really have to. Oh, my God. Isn't she tiresome? And that was back then. Now it's 12 years later. Imagine how tired the whole country is of this woman. Her endless spinning. You know, all this money coming in from these foreign countries, and including from Israelis, that didn't make it in the book for some reason. But all these Gulf countries giving her money reminds me of what Bill Clinton said about the Chinese money coming into his campaign in 1996. He said to the press corps, I saw him say it on CNN, I guess it was, in, say, 97 or 98 or something, 97 probably. He said, I don't believe that you can find any evidence of the fact that I changed policy solely because of a campaign contribution. That ought to be, you know, the Clinton campaign slogan. I don't think that you could prove my dastardly treason, so don't bother trying. And anyway, so this is anyway. I'm off the topic. The point is, so that's a big part of how we got into the war. You know, the majority of Democrats in the House voted against it. Now they were the minority in the government at the time, and they certainly weren't enough to stop the thing in the House of Representatives, but you got to give them credit for that. They did oppose it, and it was safe for them to oppose it because they weren't it wasn't going to make a difference either way. But the majority of Senate Democrats supported it, for what that's worth, if you want to somewhat differentiate there. So now the rest of the thing, and this is pretty obvious, but it bears repeating because, you know, not everybody was right back then. A lot of people are playing catch up here. That, you know, when Jeb Bush finally got his story straight and said that his poor brother was the victim of bad intelligence, that just is not how it happened. You may or may not understand, you know, I don't know. Somebody may have never told you about it. But the truth is, there was a convergence of interests that came together to support that war, and none of them had really anything to do with protecting the American people from attack with weapons of mass destruction at all. As Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, said during his victory high, I believe only in May 2003, before all the worst broke out, you know, consequences broke out. He said, well, you know, the weapons of mass destruction was what we agreed on for bureaucratic reasons. It was the one thing that we could get everybody on board for. But Rove wanted to get Bush reelected. Bush wanted to prove he was tougher than his dad. Dick Cheney wanted to create a fascist totalitarian dictatorship and make sure that his Halliburton shareholders made up for all his losses back when he was CEO. By hooking them up right. I don't know what the hell was going on with that psychopath Donald Rumsfeld. And then the neocons only care what Benjamin Netanyahu wanted, maybe even more than what Ariel Sharon wanted. What Lockheed wanted. And I guess Baker and the oil guys, they wanted some kind of regime change there, although I don't think they wanted the Chalabi plan. Oh, did I leave out the Iranians? wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein and so used Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress to feed the pro-Israel neocons a bunch of crap to fill your TV screens all day and the president's talking points all day. Quite a confluence of interest there. And it's in the memo. Here's the Downing Street memo. They somehow just, I don't know, laughed at it because Downing Street is a silly-sounding name for a street. Is that it? I don't know what it was about this that they just said, hey, let's just pretend that this is silly and unimportant, but here's what it was. Bush and Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, were meeting at Crawford, Texas, and Blair's head of the MI6, his Director of Central Intelligence, was right there at his side, and so was his Smithers. And his, and Dear Love is the name of the head of the MI6, and I forgot the name of his Smithers, but Smithers was taking notes on the entire conversation. And the notes said, they've decided they're doing the war, and they've decided that the excuse will be weapons of mass destruction, and the facts will be fixed around the policy. There was no question about it. Blair and Bush were honest with each other about it when they were talking about it in private, that they were lying to you. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. I don't know. Oh, yeah. Hey, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Coming up, John Pfeffer. He's going to say some smart stuff. I'll try to be quiet. You know, I screwed up that last segment, man. I wrapped it up all wrong. What I wanted to get back to was not just, oh, yeah, they lied to you. Everybody knows that. My point was that they're going to have to keep fighting about this. See? Jeb Bush. He can't get away from the fact his name is Bush. Hillary Clinton voted for the thing. They are the two presumed front runners by a long shot. And they both, in a sense, are responsible for what is a continuing catastrophe over there. And so, Now, I don't think there's anybody better than either of them. I mean, I guess Rand Paul is qualitatively a little bit better than Jeb. I'll give him that. But none of the other candidates are. And power is never going to let it be Rand. So just forget that. And I don't know. I mean, maybe if he would change into Ron, only younger, a little bit more acute in his, you know, campaigning message and stuff, but otherwise pure on the libertarian principle thing, that might help. But really, I mean, that's fantasy land, right? And in fact, you know what? That's Rand Paul's job right now is, hey, this is a Hail Mary pass is the best chance he's got. This is not a democracy where the question is which candidate will the people choose in the primaries and caucuses? Which candidate do the people want? It's which candidate does power want? Which candidate do the most powerful corporations and banks agree on? The arms dealers, the pill pushers, the corn farmers, you know, the welfare whores of America. Who do they want? And the only way to overcome that would be a massive popular thing, not just convincing Republican primary rank and file somehow, but convincing the American people that, hey, this is make it or break it for a free society, man. You guys want your Bill of Rights or not? Hold your nose, register Republican. Come in by the tens of millions. We need you. And if you don't do it, then it's going to be Jeb again, that kind of thing. A real fight, a real kind of libertarian crusade to stop these guys. That's the only thing that would even have a prayer. Like the most, it would have to be the most, you know, exaggerated and expansive and humongous campaign to bring on, you know, the non-political people of America. The non-voters of America, huge thing. Left, right, everyone. You want peace and the Bill of Rights? That's my only platform. Peace and the Bill of Rights. Oh, yeah, no bailouts for bankers. And just boil it down. Peace, Bill of Rights, no bailouts. Stop Jeb and Hillary. And, of course, this is so obvious. I don't know if I'll get to take credit if they ever pick it up. But Rand ought to, from now on, just talk about how Jeb ought to be running with Hillary and just make a mockery of him. And by calling his warmongering liberal. Yeah, all this big government liberal, global social engineering, hard Wilsonianism, as Max Boot calls it. That's not conservative. World empire, that's not conservative. Jeb Bush, why, he's one of these big government liberals when it comes to taking over the world. That's the only way to do it. And he's still going to lose anyway, but at least that would be great, you know? But I do think it's great that, you know, Jeb and Hillary are so far out ahead when it comes to powerful consensus of who the nominee is going to be, and yet they have this huge fatal flaw. I mean, they have dozens and probably scores and hundreds each, but I mean, this Iraq thing is just haunting them like, you know, Bush Jr.'s little Iraqi ghost that follows him around, you know, from that not very funny Onion thing about that. So anyway, man, and we still got 18 months to go here. So this should be fun. And listen, every Republican candidate except Rand and Hillary has basically no competition. I guess I'll get to Jim Webb in a second. But every other Republican other than Rand is saying, yeah, be tough, bomb, this, that. Ted Cruz is a little bit peacenik on some of this stuff to the slightest degree. But, yeah, basically the consensus is Uncle Sam must, you know, hold a knife to the whole world's throat all day, every day from now on or else. And also cut throats, too. Hold a knife to the throat, everybody, you know, that they're not actually slicing. And so the only way to overcome that, I mean, from Rand's side, should be, it's all of them versus me. I love you guys, but you're all wrong about the most important thing in the world. Let's fight for 18 months. You don't stand a chance. But otherwise, my prediction is that, I guess here's where I could bring up Jim Webb. Now, Jim Webb, to me, he pissed me off when he came out against the Iran nuclear deal. God dang it, man. There's supposed to be something unique and useful about you. And him being a tough guy, Marine, and Reagan Secretary of the Navy, and kind of, sort of, somewhat a peacenik. Again, being able to attack Hillary from the right for peace. That is powerful because it confuses the message a little bit, right? Tough guy like him ought to be even tougher than her. But instead, he's saying, no way, she's out of bounds. And we need to scale this stuff back. I know something about it, right? He's a Vietnam veteran and all this kind of stuff. So there's still an opportunity for him to say, no, we don't need a bunch of Hillary Clinton warmongering and you know, global American school marming and shut that down and, you know, fight with her. But I don't know. And that's, again, that just like with Rand Paul, that's the only prayer he's got. I mean, Jim Webb, he's a pretty boring guy. He would have to really get out there and go, all right, look, American people. This is a holy crusade to stop the damned Clintons and Bushes and the empire. We've had it. Come on. You know, attack it that way. Make it that big of a deal. This isn't about, you know, two different candidates. This is about two entirely different systems of government. You want world empire and slavery and destruction, or you want to be free. Now, I don't think he's got anything like that in him, unfortunately. I mean, I think he's got the palest shadows of that in him, but I don't think he recognizes that that's how to do it, is get in there and just fight like hell for peace from her right, in a way that just helps to confuse and clarify a few things. And then if he did that real well, if Rand could get better and better instead of worse and worse, and if Webb could get better and better instead of worse and worse, then there's a great, you know, theme in there. You know, these guys really, and especially if they're always accusing Jeb and Hillary of being useful as each other's running mates, you know, that they ought to be together, that could really help clarify things. I know I'm plagiarizing myself from back when I was saying Ron Paul should run with Dennis Kucinich, but wouldn't that be cool if after Jeb and Rand, I mean, if after Webb and Rand lose, I mean, assuming the best of them, squinting very tight and trying to ignore all the horrible things about them both, the pale imitations of Ron and Dennis that they are, but assuming the best of them, wouldn't that be cool if after they lose their respective party nominations, that then if they run together and try to form a new party and just insist, just demand every day, all day, every day, demand that Jeb and Hillary run together on one ticket so that we can have the American People Party versus the evil, powerful imperial warlords of the IRS party. Because that would just help clarify things for people. They'd still lose, but it would be a very teachable moment, don't you think? All right, I swear to God, next segment I'm covering Iraq and Syria wars, and then John Pfeffer's going to come on to talk about East Asia. So, be cool. Hang tight. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Well, as Lou Rockwell once said, it's a heck of a note to have to root for the Rockefellers.
It probably goes even further. I never quite understood why we have to help or at least endorse the overthrow of Assad. And I'm not sure we really knew what we were doing when we made the statement, because there wasn't any real action following on that. What has happened, however, in the last 2 years or so since that happened is a demonstration of the fact that whether we like it or not, Assad does have some significant support in Syrian society, and probably more than any one of the several groups that are opposing him. So that has to be taken into account. I don't think that those who oppose him, perhaps with the exception of the relatively small and weakest group among the resistors who favor us, he has a bigger, better standing than any one of them. Combined, maybe there is some sort of division in the country across the board, but he is still there. And I think if we want to, in some fashion, promote the end of the horrible bloodletting and the progressive destruction of that country, not the promotion of democracy, I think we have to take that reality into account.
General Scarfor, quickly, your comments at all on this topic?
I pretty much agree with Zbig on Syria.
All right, so that's Zbigniew Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft saying, what the hell are we doing trying to overthrow Assad over there? And Brzezinski, he's being really polite when he's saying, hey, it's the weakest of the opposition groups is the one that's pro-us. And Assad is more popular than any one of the opposition groups. He's kind of just... it's implicit, we all know, but he's not specifically addressing the two major opposition groups are the Islamic State of the Caliph Ibrahim and al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And the FSA are, for intents and purposes, just their weapon and money acquiring branch, acquisition branch, I guess I should say. I mean, I guess they keep putting together these little militias who do some fighting, but just because someone's willing to receive money and weapons from America doesn't mean they're loyal to America. And as Patrick Coburn and many other great reporters have emphasized all along, there's no real difference between the FSA and the al-Nusra Front. And for that matter, the Islamic State. They're all a bunch of head-chopping lunatics. The FSA cuts off people's heads, too. It's just a matter of, who's getting along with who. And when he talks about these single groups, it's just a matter of time, isn't it? And somewhere there's a doomsday clock ticking down to when Nusra and ISIS put their differences aside and go ahead and join forces. I mean, at this point, it seems like Nusra is just, for intents and purposes anyway, the shock troops for the Islamic State in Syria. They take the territory. The Islamic State takes it up. Nusra moves forward. The Islamic State fills in the vacuum where they've kicked the Syrian government's army out. And I know that there's some ebb and flow in there, but... And what's the difference between al-Qaeda and Nusra? I mean, pardon me, al-Qaeda is Nusra. What's the difference between them and the Islamic State? Only chain of command. Only who do you prefer to take orders from? And those kinds of questions can be negotiated. And in fact, I mentioned this before, but it's really interesting. There's this gigantic story in The Guardian about how Stanley Cohen, the radical left-wing Jewish lawyer from New York who represents Hamas in their lawsuits in America, I guess, he knew a guy who knew a guy in Kuwait who knew a guy in Al-Qaeda in Jordan who is, their spiritual, had some kind of spiritual authority there. And his student had gone off with the Islamic State. And Stanley Cohen was trying to negotiate for the release of, is it Kasig? I'm going from memory here now. I'm sorry. I often am, but for some reason I'm not certain about this guy's name. I think it was Kasig was the guy that got killed, was the hostage that got killed, one of them. And Stanley Cohen was trying to negotiate for his release, and as part of the deal, he was working on healing the rift between this Al-Qaeda Islamic scholar in Jordan and this ISIS Islamic scholar, his former student, in Iraq. And if they could heal their rift and say, no, actually, yeah, we can compromise and, you can do this as long as you call it that or whatever, then that could have been the end of the split right there. It'd be that easy. And maybe that's difficult, but then again, it goes to show it's within reach of those factions to resolve their problem, and then it's an even greater problem. And, this is comic book crazy, the American policy of backing the Mujahideen against Assad all this time. And Assad runs a fascist military police state. I'm not saying he doesn't. I said that long before the war started. But just because he's a dictator doesn't mean it's okay for the Americans and their allies to do all of this. I said to Flint Leverett, who used to be, high-level boss of analysts at the CIA and on the National Security Council and all of this, I said, when the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks are just funneling guns and money to these jihadist groups, isn't that just plausible deniability for the Americans? Isn't it just not very plausible deniability? And he said, yeah. And then again, he quit answering me when I asked him to come on the show anymore, so I don't know, man. I don't know what he says now, but, his position at the time was, hell yeah, we're talking, 2012. Hell yeah, the American government knows that all their support for jihad in Syria, that the field is dominated by the al-Nusra Front. And then later the Islamic State broke off from them, but that wasn't until spring of 2013. And anyway, So, yeah, it's just outright amazing. And so there's Zbigniew Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft, Jimmy Carter and George Bush Sr.'s national security advisors saying, hell if I know what's going on here, although they know it's the neocons, man. It's the Israel lobby in the United States. They decide this. And it's the same joke because it hasn't changed. I've been making it for a year now. That you realize that if it wasn't for the Israel lobby and their treason, oh, I guess none of this would have happened in the first place, but if it wasn't for their insistence that Iran and Iran's allies and Hezbollah and in Damascus were paramount as far as national security concerns, if it wasn't for all that, then we'd have a full-scale war probably against the Islamic State for Assad and for a body in Iraq. And the reason we don't is because all of our allies, and especially the Israelis, and the Saudis, I guess, and the Turks for that matter, they'll prefer otherwise.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Thanks for hanging around. I promised you John Pfeffer. I got him on the line here. And, you know, this article is right up my alley here. You know, the worst welfare queens in America are, of course, black single mothers. No, I'm just kidding. It's the military-industrial complex, the and probably foremost among them all, well, I guess the F-35. But other than that, it'd have to be the so-called missile defense industry. They're not getting any better respect from me than that. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on again.
Very good to have you back on the show. Everybody, you know John Pfeffer. He's at Foreign Policy in Focus. I forgot the name of it. The Center for what again?
Institute for Policy Studies.
That's exactly why I couldn't remember it, because I had the first word of it wrong. Anyway, yes, exactly. So here we go. Reprinted. Most of your stuff is reprinted at antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Pfeffer. And this one is called The Madness of THAAD, THAAD. U.S. push for missile defense in Asia will only lead to more missiles and less defense. Now, that sounds plausible enough to me as a tagline, but please explain, sir.
Sure. Well, right now, the United States is basically trying to get Korea, South Korea, that is, to sign on to what is called THAAD, or the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, which is basically just, as you said, missile defense at a high altitude. That distinguishes it from what South Korea already has, which is PAC-2 and 3, which are the Patriot systems. Which are basically for not high altitude, but for lower altitude interceptive missiles. South Korea, however, is not enthusiastic about it because China's not enthusiastic about it. And China and South Korea have a pretty strong trade relationship. South Korea doesn't want to piss China off, mm-hmm. and China is pissed off.
Oh, that's good. I didn't realize. I guess I had kind of glossed over that part of it where the South Koreans are real hesitant to do this. And now, tell me this, we could get to the whole ridiculous missile defense and outer space systems and all of that, but when it comes to the Patriot systems, I know it was a bunch of hype back during the Gulf War, but did they ever get those figured out where they're, you know, more or less effective against, you know, whatever the North Korean equivalent of the Scud is, medium range or short range missile like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there hasn't been an opportunity, at least in Asia, to test that out. We have really no idea what would happen should North Korea send some of those missiles.
Well, like when they test the outer space ones, we know it's a hoax every time. They have to admit it. There's just no denying, right, that they pre-program all the coordinates and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But do you have any indication about the Patriot weather in tests? Do they have to completely rig the tests, or is it proven at all? Do you know?
No. I mean, those are, you know, with lower altitude, like, you know, Israel's Iron Dome, they do hit them some things, some incoming. It really depends on how many incoming. As you know, there are a number of missiles that did make it through Iron Dome and struck Israel proper. So they're not foolproof, but they do make some hits now and then, definitely.
Those are definitely subsonic, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever Hamas has are basically just, I don't want to say just bottle rockets, but they're what, mortars at worst. That's not quite the same thing as a real missile, I guess. I don't know, actually, the difference between ballistic missile speeds or what. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think we would see less accuracy if we were dealing with something coming out of North Korea. I mean, obviously, North Korea has other means of attacking South Korea, namely artillery, which would be closer to what we're talking about in terms of the Hamas's capability. Mm-hmm. And North Korea has tons of that. So, and that would be, you know, given the amount of artillery that North Korea has, that would be tough to defend against. I mean, it has considerably more than what Hamas has. Mm-hmm.
And now this may have just been propaganda by these THAAD guys or something, but I saw a headline that says North Korea claims to have miniaturized nuclear weapons. And I was thinking, I'm yet to see any proof that they know how to really split atoms when they try to do a plutonium bomb, much less miniaturize it. What do you think of that?
Well, it depends on which propaganda you want to accept, because that's not only propaganda coming out of our military-industrial complex, but it's propaganda coming out of their military-industrial complex. North Korea proudly announced that it has had the miniaturization capability. But then again, North Korea makes all sorts of claims that it hasn't backed up. So it really is, it's your guess as well as mine whether North Korea is able to miniaturize, in other words, to make a warhead out of its nuclear material and put it on the end of a rocket so that it can send it somewhere. It has shown no indication it's able to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, their first two tests were fizzles, and then the third one, I guess nobody knew what happened, but I think we could probably assume the worst of that, right? And none of those had anything to do with a miniaturized device. They were just trying to get it to work at all.
That's correct. I mean, those would be parallel efforts. So they could be able to miniaturize something and put it at the end of a warhead, but it wouldn't necessarily mean that it was nuclear capable. So, you know, I frankly have my doubts as to what North Korea has or doesn't have. I do know that North Korea is heavily invested into getting us to think that it has these capabilities, because after all, what's the point of putting all this money into something that doesn't work? It's supposed to have a deterrent capability. Deterrence is all about perception. We have to perceive that it has this capability, or else deterrence doesn't mean anything at all.
Mm-hmm. And now, you raise an interesting point in here that I think people often overlook. I mean, it seems like all things being equal, which they never are, it would be perfectly fine to build an anti-missile shield all over the place, except for the fact, the humongous one, that America doesn't have benign intentions. And anytime they're building a missile shield, whether they're trying to do it in Poland or in South Korea, what it looks like to the Russians and to the Chinese is we're just arming up for a fist fight. Or armoring up, I guess, and creating at least our perceived ability to do a first strike without having to suffer nuclear retaliation. If we can get them all good enough on our first go at it and shoot down what remaining retaliatory missiles they might have left at the end of that. And so that's why, to them, they take this real seriously. It's not like we're talking a peace-loving republic with a missile shield. We're talking about a world empire with very explicit designs on Asia, East and West, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is something that, you know, arms control folks have realized for more than 30 years, close to 40 years. In other words, during the height of the U.S.-Soviet confrontation, there were anti-ballistic missile capabilities. It wasn't quite a shield exactly that could cover enormous amounts of territory, but we did have ABM sites, anti-ballistic missile sites, that did have the capability, or at least we thought on both sides, the capability of shielding small areas, like around a big city or around a missile battery. And arms controllers in the early 70s said, hey, you know, if we permit as many ABM sites as possible, then we'll basically have not only an ABM race, in other words, both sides will be you know, spending enormous amounts of money to create as many ABM sites around the country as possible. But both sides would also invest more money in additional missiles to overwhelm the ABM sites. And so arms controllers thought, okay, well, one way we can block this, at least initially, is to put a limit, a cap on ABM sites. And that was the ABM Treaty of 72. It lasted until George W. Bush decided that he didn't want it any longer, about a year after he took office, because it stood in the way of his own idea of creating missile defense or Star Wars. And so they abrogated the treaty. Unfortunately, as a result, not only are we, the United States, proliferating our missile defense technology, but other countries are as well. And at the beginning of my article, I talk about how the Pentagon has finally realized this and has gone to Congress and said, hey, we need this modernized missile, nuclear missile, because of other countries' missile defense systems. So that's the dilemma we're in again, 40 years after the ABM treaty.
Yeah, the mad dog chasing its tail there. All right, it's the madness of THAAD. U.S. push for missile defense in Asia will only lead to more missiles and less defense. More on America's Asia pivot with John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy and Focus right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, by the way, for those of you who listen to the interview archives only later, you should know there's a new way to support the show, patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, or just follow the link at scotthorton.org. Check it out. See what it's about. John Pfeffer, he's on the line. Foreign Policy and Focus is where he writes The Madness of THAAD, THAAD, all caps there. And that's for high altitude defense. Now, let me make sure I got your story straight here, John. You're saying that not as a pretext, but actually it's supposed to be geared toward North Korea. But the Chinese take it as a threat anyway. I think implicit is because they only have a couple of dozen nukes, maybe a few dozen or something, right? Not the thousands that the Russians and the Americans have. And so they're really worried that this is all about them and all about first strike. But do I read you right that you're saying it really is about North Korea, even though it's really just about selling missile defense because the North Koreans don't have any high altitude, anything to shoot down anyway? But that's basically what the policy, at least as close as we can get to reality, that's what it's based on.
Well, you're right. I mean, basically, we're talking about something that costs, you know, upwards nearly $1 billion for one of these systems. And that's a lot of money that Lockheed Martin could make selling it to South Korea and potentially Japan as well. In terms of the threat, well, of course, the United States says it's worried about North Korea. And I trust that it is worried about North Korea. But its partner, South Korea, you know, doesn't need THAAD to defend against North Korea because South Korea is right next to North Korea. So there's nothing that's going to come out of North Korea, whether it has it or not, to attack South Korea that's going to be high altitude like that. It's going to be artillery. It's going to be something that can be addressed or not addressed by PAC, by the Patriot system. So fundamentally, THAAD would be used in any functional way against the Chinese nuclear capability. And while it's true that China has a nuclear capability that's far less than anything the United States or Russia has, it is in the process of modernizing it. And one of the most recent innovations that China has been exploring is MIRV, another term from the 1970s. It's almost as if we're getting these terrible acid flashbacks from the 1970s. First, the ABM with the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and now MIRV, which was multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles. MIRV was this big debate between the United States and the Soviet Union about the ability of a warhead to basically send out little warheads to sprout like a fireworks and send out these little multiple reentry vehicles or warheads that would be independently targeted. In other words, you could target them at different sites, different missile sites, cities, etc. Something that hitherto only a few members of the nuclear club a capability that they had. And China now, too, is exploring this as part of its overall modernization. So, you know, again, we're getting into this dynamic where China is fearing the ability of the United States and its allies to take away its deterrent capability and therefore modernizing its nuclear arsenal in order to, again, regain that deterrent capability. So we're going to see a nuclear arms race. If THAAD goes through, if it's pushed onto our South Korean allies and into Japan, accelerate in East Asia.
Mm. Yeah, well, and you know, it's interesting. Maybe it's just a side note, and maybe the Chinese would have figured it out themselves anyway. Nobody called them stupid, even when they adopted Maoism. But it was Bill Clinton who hired John Wong and put him in the Commerce Department, James Riotti's guy, and put him in charge of licensing Loral and Hughes Corporation to transfer the multiple reentry vehicle technology to China back in the 1990s, obviously, clearly in direct exchange for campaign cash. And so they said, hey, look, everybody, Johnny Chung and Charlie Tree, when the real scandal was John Wong and his licensing of the transfers of this technology, which all got swept under the rug back then.
Mm-hmm. And we are, with the Obama administration, in a similar kind of licensing frenzy. It may not be in the same exchange for political favors and contributions as we saw with the Clinton administration, but it is in exchange for contracts from the military-industrial complex, which has gained tremendously. You know, the Obama administration has surpassed any other administration in history, including the predecessor, George W. Bush, in terms of arms exports, which is really quite remarkable considering the amount of arms exports that our predecessor administrations were engaged in. And part of that is as well licensing agreements. In other words, agreements that provide technology so that our allies and occasionally even our competitors are able to produce competitive technologies. So the most controversial, of course, is drone technology, which we hitherto had, tried to retain our technological edge. But now, under the Obama administration, we've decided we're going to go ahead and export that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really amazing the way they can just keep escalating this. The way, can you talk to us about when China hit a satellite with a missile, and what they said at the time was, hey, America, stop militarizing space. We're just trying to prove that we can defend ourselves. And the Americans said, oh, my God, China just invented the militarization of space. We're going to have to defend ourselves from them.
Yeah, this has been a major issue, again, unfortunately, since the 1970s, and that is the degree to which the arms race has spread to space. It has involved as well a kind of satellite arms race or a satellite race among all the countries that are capable of launching satellites. Because, of course, the ability to launch a satellite, the ability to knock a satellite out of orbit, is directly related to one's ability to launch ICBMs and to be accurate about the targeting of ICBMs. So this was China saying, hey, you know, the United States wants to achieve full spectrum dominance, which of course includes outer space, but there are other countries that are interested in either maintaining the demilitarization of space or at least having some capability in space that would be rival to the United States. Hitherto, a number of countries in East Asia had remained outside of this, Japan primarily, but Japan too basically changed its operating system, if you will, to permit its engagement in the militarization of space. Korea, South Korea has a satellite capability. North Korea, for many years, was kind of essentially hiding its nuclear program under the rubric of trying to get a satellite into space. It either did or didn't. It did maybe briefly, and the satellite was up there broadcasting the song of Kim Il-sung for a period of time before it fell out of orbit. So this is a major kind of competition in East Asia over the skies above the country. And it's not just about the kind of ability to target ICBMs. It's also, of course, about surveillance capabilities. And that brings us back to THAAD, because one of the things the Chinese government is worried about, not only is THAAD possibly going to degrade China's deterring capability, but there is a surveillance capability that's built into THAAD that could get additional information about what's going on inside China. And China's not all that enthusiastic about that. The United States has retorted that it has other ways of getting that information, but of course, THAAD would be an enhancement of that surveillance capability.
Mm-hmm. And now, so you mentioned the military-industrial complex and all the weapons sales and all of this, but when you say, in the article, we should be paying attention to our national interests instead of letting Lockheed Martin determine the security policies. Is that the proverbial Lockheed Martin, or that is, no, really, they and their lobbyists have dreamed up this crap just to steal our money, and that's really, you know, right where the nexus lies, in their offices in our U.S. Congress?
This would be literally Lockheed Martin, because it's the producer of THAAD. It's not the only kind of military contractor that's involved in missile defense, but this specific system is directly connected to Lockheed Martin. And of course, you know, you're not going to have a lobbyist from Lockheed Martin going into Washington, D.C. and saying, hey, let's restart the six-party talks with North Korea. That's fundamentally not in their interest. They may be neutral on the question, but they're not going to lobby in favor of that. And at the moment, you know, we haven't had six-party talks for several years. The Chinese are interested in restarting it. Russians are. South Korea, Japan, willing to go along. The United States, not put a lot of political capital into that. The Obama administration, for a number of reasons, has basically been focused more on the so-called Pacific Pivot, its components being either the sale of military technology to our allies, the construction of new military bases in the region, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the economic component. The six-party talks has not been part of the Pacific Pivot, and certainly Lockheed Martin and its denizens are not in support of such diplomatic efforts.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you may know, Medea Benjamin and a bunch of other activists from, I guess, around the world are celebrating International Women's Day, or Women's Day, this Saturday, I think it is, to just march right across the DMZ, and they convinced the North and the South Korean governments to allow it. And they're saying, we're just tired of waiting on these politicians and their stupid talks and their unending peace processes that never go anywhere. We're just going to do this thing. I wonder what you think of that and the prospects for, I mean, what the hell? Obama's made some kind of joke about it's his effort. Years the lame duck end of his presidency means he can either do nothing or he can do whatever he wants. He's trying to make peace with Iran. He's making peace with Cuba. Why not just go ahead and call this whole thing off? It's stupid anyway. Yeah, they're a totalitarian dictatorship, but so is America too. So
I think what Medea and Gloria Steinem and Christine Ahn are doing is great, and more power to them. What they'd like is to get a peace treaty signed. So they are frustrated with the efforts of diplomats, but they are trying to get some kind of a peace treaty signed that would effectively replace the armistice that ended the fighting in the Korean War in 1953. There is a possibility. I mean, it would be great to see Obama kind of turn around and say, as you said, This is my lame duck period, and, you know, hell with it. I'm just going to do what I think is necessary in terms of kind of pushing the planet towards peace. The initiatives with Iran, with Cuba, are definitely laudatory, and I think it would be fabulous to add Korea. A Korean peace treaty is kind of the third jewel in that crown.
Hey, listen, as long as I'm keeping you a minute over time here, is it okay if I ask you one more thing here?
Sure.
Yeah, because isn't it right that George W. Bush, when he sent Christopher Hill over there before he sabotaged his own dumb thing, was actually making some pretty good progress there in the last years of the junior administration?
That's correct. Absolutely. And it was a complete 180-degree turn on the Bush administration's part, since it had come in 2001 vehemently opposed to any kind of diplomatic engagement with North Korea. So, yes, by 2006, they'd realized that that effort was producing absolutely nothing and that they had to try something new. So it is possible that we could see a similar kind of pivot, if you will, from the Obama administration, realizing that its own kind of hostile policy toward North Korea has only led to, you know, North Korea having more weapons and not changing its internal policies at all. So maybe it's time for a new kind of approach.
Yeah, it is strange that the Obama guys have decided, let's just never even mention North Korea. Let's just pretend it doesn't exist for 8 years because we've got other problems and whatever. I guess they invoke it as an excuse to sell some missiles here and there. But as far as diplomacy, they just don't even touch it whatsoever, huh?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I think it was a strategic decision that in the past, negotiations with North Korea did not yield great dividends, whereas investment into negotiations with Iran and Cuba obviously are yielding dividends. The mention of North Korea is somewhat of an embarrassment to the Obama administration because their opponents in Congress and the Republican Party can say, hey, you know, on your watch, North Korea went nuclear, which isn't exactly true. But anyway, they can use that argument. And so the less they talk about North Korea, the less they open themselves up to that kind of criticism.
Yeah. In other words, it's all about politics, not the national interest, like everything else.
Correct.
Yep. All right. Great. Thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it, John.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. That's John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy in Focus at FPIF.org. And this one is there and at antiwar.com as well. The Madness of THAAD.